Thank you for inviting me back. Has anybody any memory of me talking here before a number of years ago? Do you know when that was? Because I should know. One of the challenges I have is memory. Since the MD I had in 1997, I had such severe memory loss and heart problems. I was put on disability, long-term disability. And after a number of months of intensive neurological testing and cardiac testing, I was put on a disability, no treatment, and just kind of shelved. I had no capability of standing in front of a group like this to talk. I had no capability, really, of going out in public. This number of people, it was not a possibility for me to be around. And so it was very interesting for me to journey into a life of isolation and limitation. Ironically, I was a rehabilitation counselor working with people on disability, helping them back into the world, and I fell into a world of disability myself with no medical treatment possible, apparently. It's something that I will talk about a little bit more later, about how people can face disability head on and create a world of ability just as they are, and sometimes watch miracles happen. More recently, I had another open heart surgery. I've had two. One when I was 25 years old to put an aortic valve into my heart. I was born with a congenital defect in my heart. And when I was 25 years old, I had a heart valve put in, which lasted 30 years. In 1997, apparently a clot from the valve spun off the valve, and as it went through my brain, created a grand mal seizure that ended up in a near-death experience. And I died in bed.
In front of me.
In front of my love here who resuscitated me. And that's the story that she will tell, both watching me physically die and energetically watching my soul disappear as well. More recently, about a year and a half ago, the symptoms started reemerging. As of last May, I was not able to drive. Symptoms have increased to the point where my memory, again, is very challenged. I just spent several days at a conference of which I have very little memory except my notes.
You had a good time, by the way.
I had a wonderful time. She tells me I had a wonderful time. So I guess that's it. So my excuse for stumbling around here is going to be it's cognitively a challenge to still be with people. One thing that I can do is talk about my experiences, the melding of matter and spirit. It's a lifelong interest. It's something that I have studied in my graduate school. It's something that I have direct experience, both cognitively and experientially, in an in-depth experience in other spiritual states that I access directly. I'm walking through the abilities that I do have. Over the last several months, what's opened up to me is these kind of venues. I can stand in front of a group and hold forth. I'm not able to walk. I cannot work. I can sit and take a client's data and put it into a computer without having seizures. So I'm recreating my life day by day by day, and this is part of that creation. So I thank you for the opportunity to take a step. And I don't know where that's going to go, but maybe I'll come back in a year or two and tell you. And part of that, as I look over here to see Dina, this last 2 weeks, she's helped me put some of the PowerPoint slides together we'll see today. And that, again, is another story. When I started my journey back to the world, productive world, 2002, about 4 or 5 years after my first disability, was actually doing a talk from a group about changing consciousness. I think what I'd like to do is start it with Elka's observation of what happened and then go into the actual experience I have in the NDE of leaving this body and opening up.
I just want to let you all know that this is the crème de la crème, the cherry on the top of the sundae, the dessert portion of a two-week journey that we've been taking. 2 weeks ago, we flew into Salt Lake City, rented a car, drove through snow and over mountain passes and hill and dale and a lot of rocks and mud to Santa Fe, where we we attended a science and consciousness conference. 5 days of geniuses, people, scientists, ministers, and priests, people who were biologists, geologists, photographers, movie makers, physicists, I don't know. They were all incredible people and all come together from all over the world to talk about science and spirit, science and spirituality. It was absolutely amazing. We had a great time. I didn't have a grandma seizure, and even I couldn't take it all in. I don't blame you. But what we did discover was a number of things, and that is these experiences, something like a near-death experience, something like an out-of-body experience, something like when you are praying and you make a connection with the divine, with God, something like seeing things. I happen to see what are called energy fields or auras, and I'll tell you my story of my very first aura many years ago, but all these experiences have in common this one thing. It takes us out of the ordinary into divinity, into extraordinary, into those unusual moments in time when it's, wake up, right? You know? And I know you've all had something, at least one something in your life, where you thought, uh-oh, this is not all there is. And so my story basically begins with another husband, actually. No offense, Jim. You're the best. I was married before. I was 21, newlywed. And my first really, well, I had very unusual experiences all my life, frankly. But let me just back up then. When I was a child, I saw clouds of color around people, and I thought everybody did. I thought this was just a normal thing, but it wasn't. And so eventually, like a lot of children do, if they're not encouraged, or it's just not normal within society, right? It went away. These beautiful clouds of color. So now, fast forward to my first husband. I'm a newlywed. I propped up on one elbow watching the beloved sleep. And, you know, and I'm just watching him breathe and glow and glow. And I sat up. Far out. This was the 70s. Far out. What is this? And I was thinking, think quick. Because I forgot all about my experiences, my enchanted experiences as a child. Now it got my attention and I was wide awake. And I started to consider. I was studying psychology at the time in university. And I thought, okay, all right. There's a term for this. No, not psychotic break. No, no, it must be love. Isn't there some brain chemicals that are released when you're in love? Endorphins. I think that's what it was called. And, you know, my brain went into overtime figuring this out. But the glow didn't go away. I thought, well, this is really interesting. I think I really must be in love. But just calm down. It will go away. If you go to sleep, you know, next morning, all will be right with the world again, and we'll just go back to normal. No more endorphins. I went back to sleep, woke up the next morning. He is now, my first husband, he's standing in front of the Venetian blinds looking out, you know, out the window, and he's shining like a god. And I'm thinking, uh-oh. I'm just like, hello, why are you still glowing? I'm not saying any of these things, but in my mind I'm thinking, okay, I'm really in love now, or I'm in trouble. This was a stressful year. You know, the mind does these things, right? It's one of the things we're going to talk about is your reaction to something that happens that just takes you out of the box, right? Takes you out of your ordinary. Again, I had forgotten all about the magical experiences I had as a child. I sat there and considered, and I just kind of regarded him. And the next thing I know, I thought to myself, and this is seriously, folks, I thought, wonder what's going on with his kidney, because there's that smudgy spot around, oh no, his kidney is talking to me now. No, 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 no. Go to the window, look at the people going off to work, and see if they're still glowing. If they are, you're in trouble. if they're not, it's endorphins or love or something, and, you know, we'll figure it out. And, of course, I think you know the end to that story. That was the beginning, 32 years ago, of my seeing what are called auras or energy fields. I didn't know that. It took a call to my mother and an absolute panic a couple of weeks later, and the help of actually a physicist, a physics professor, to explain to me what was happening to me. And that people do this all over the world. It's really not as uncommon as one would think. And in fact, all of you perceive energy of some kind. I would think, don't you, when you come into a room sometimes, right? You come into a friend's party and there's some people there that you're not too terribly fond of, and don't you just kind of feel this, right? And I'm like, oh, I just remembered I had somewhere else to go. Or meeting a perfect stranger, and you feel, you know, we met Eldon and Susan and Dina, their daughter. It was family. It's like meeting old family. And that was an energy thing. So all of us can experience these expanded states, if you will, of awareness. I just happen to see funny. And I see in full color. I see actual colorful clouds. It gives me a lot of information, including when a person is about to die. So when I see a person who is about to make their transition, I actually literally see them almost like pulling up roots. They fade out and expand out like that. And I've been with many, I'm a counselor now, and I've been with many, 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 many people at their deathbed or shortly before they die. And it's actually, when one opens to it, it can be a very, very beautiful. Well, fast forward to 12 years ago. Oh my gosh, time flies. I'm also an inspirational speaker, and I had a counseling appointment in a town, several hours away. In other words, I was going to be away for a few days on a business trip. I'd say 9 days before this business trip, I got a call from the people who own this lovely center. Elka, we have to cancel your talk and your class and your appointments. Pardon me? What? And they said, yeah, and then they gave an excuse. And to this day, I was in so much shock, I really don't remember what they said because it was weird. I had a waiting list of people coming to see me. You know, the place was booked. It was very strange. One doesn't just get canceled 9 days before a talk, usually. So I thought, I guess God wants me to be home. And I thought quickly, and I thought, well, there's some people who want to see me anyway here in my neighborhood. I made some phone calls, put together a last-minute class. And so on the day that I was supposed to be in Portland, Oregon, I was in our little town of McConnor, Washington, had a marvelous day, taught a beautiful class, and was lovely and spiritual. And I was pooped afterwards, like I usually am after a good day's work. And I went to bed early that night. As much as I can talk about how beautiful a transition is, a death is, or can be, you don't want to see your beloved go away, right? So I was fast asleep. I barely heard my husband crawl into bed next to me. I kind of snuggled up next to him and went back to sleep. And then I awoke to him screaming like he was being murdered. It was just the most horrifying scream I've ever heard in my life. His back arched up in the gloom of the bedroom. I could barely see him. His back arched up as if he was being electrocuted, slammed back down to the bed, and then he died. He quit breathing, and his heart stopped. And I know when his heart stops because he has a ticker. He has an artificial heart valve, so literally, there was silence. So now, two things are going on, because really who we are, all of us, we are human and we are being. And what an interesting word, right? Human being. What is that? The human Elka was in absolute stark raving terror and shock, but I'm very good in emergencies and I started resuscitation moves, dialed 911, dialed my mother because our children, our two beautiful boys, were small at the time, and, you know, did all the things that one needs to do. Then there was the being of me, the somebody that is a little bit transcendent to this, a little bit above this. And I was watching my husband's aura, which usually blossoms around him like a flower, go. And it's kind of hanging out on the ceiling. And I'm thinking, no, 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 no. You know, so that the spiritual healer in me, you know, I'm doing all these things. The human is saying, you get back down in here. You can't leave now. No, 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 you can't. Don't you leave me. Eventually, his breathing started again, a very strange breath. I didn't know what was going on. He had a little bit of blood coming from his mouth. I thought, my God, what's that? You know, I mean, it was just a very horrifying sight. And finally, because we have a volunteer emergency responders, they came up 15, maybe 20 minutes later. It took them a while to get there because we live in a rural place. He was at that point breathing normally. The beautiful cloud that was up there drifted back into his body. When his eyes fluttered awake as these EMTs were trying to attach, you know, the little thing to his thumb to check his oxygen and give him oxygen and take tests and this and that. He just looked at them. He looked like he had come back from heaven. He had this beatific smile on his face. And your face was just lit up, sweetheart. It was just lit up. I mean, I've seen auras before, but this was, wow. You know, he just really looked like he had come back from an appointment with the divine. So, and he started pushing away the guys, you know, saying, I'm sorry, you must have the wrong house. What are you doing here? Could you please leave now? And, you know, and then he fell back asleep. And then he, excuse me, but, you know, I'm okay. And just this kind of singy-songy, very light voice. Again, he was totally unaware that he had died. Then he saw my face. And I was probably about as green as his shirt, you know, white-green. Honey, please do what they say. And basically, the rest is history. I just want, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but I just want to tell you what the after effects for me. Because there may be people in this room who have watched their beloveds pass or have had to jump into a C situation. I know that how powerfully devastating it can be and how powerful it can be in life. I mean, it definitely has made me grateful for every single day. I've even had near-death experiences of my own, but nothing takes the place of watching somebody you love die. I would say that how it's changed me now is an appreciation of every day. But I also have to admit, definitely, and especially since he's almost died twice now on me. What, you don't like me? That I do watch the guy. I mean, sometimes he'll be, you know, relaxing or something, and if he breathes a little funny, I'll be, you know, and he'll go, cut it out, I'm fine, I'm fine. Or, are you okay? Yes, dear, I'm fine. He has to be very forgiving of this worry wart, you know, nowadays. Things are becoming a lot more calmer in me, because I do realize that when we do have that final divine appointment, that is that divine appointment. And I'll have to be with it at that particular time. Meanwhile, I'm enjoying every moment. So you want to share your experience, dear?
Well, I think I had the easy part. At least, yeah. In the beginning. Well, evidently that was only 20 minutes. The experience I had lasted several hours from my perspective. And what I woke up to was, like Elka said, I woke up in this beautiful, serene state. And I saw the Spiderman walk through my bedroom, wondering what the heck a fireman was doing in my bedroom. And as I wondered that, I just kind of put off to sleep again, going, oh, that's interesting. And his presence wasn't enough really to wake me up. I just fell asleep again. And then I woke up again when the guy put in some sort of a probe on my finger. And I said, I don't need this. And took it off and fell asleep again. So it took a while for them to really rouse me. And told him finally just to get out of my bedroom, because I was in this wonderful, beautiful presence state. So let me tell you a little bit about what I actually experienced. And I can only tell you a little bit about it. And probably you'll hear a real common refrain from people who've had near-death experiences or other transformative experiences. They'll say, I can't put this into words. I cannot understand it myself. There's no words to encompass what I experienced. So I'll do what I can here. And I'll try to do a little bit in pictures too. It's, I've spent the last 20 years interviewing people, talking to people that have had transcendent experiences either through crisis or through NDEs or just incredible spiritual experiences. Very, very similar kinds of statements I get from them. So let me give you mine here. I'm going to talk just about a piece of this, the whole experience that I think would be common to you. There was several other segments that were, I think, well, just more personal. Beginning of it, I think, is a fairly typical experience that many NDEers talk about it, and that is approaching life. The initial phases of it was actually feeling suspended in really an infinite soup, right? I had no context. I just felt suspended. No up, down, here, there, just a presence. There was an awareness of myself, but no context, no nothing else around me. Finally, I became aware that I was kind of immersed in something. I felt the presence of something. But again, without context, without contrast, there wasn't any way to see me versus something else. And slowly, this presence began to coalesce in front of me as the light that people experience being drawn towards. The light took form, and again, it was an indescribable presence that had nothing around it. I stared at it, and stared at it, and I stared at what was not around it. There wasn't any time, there wasn't any space, there wasn't any dimensions, there was nothing. And as I looked at it, I really realized that it took this form of a discrete light because that's the only way my mind could encapsulate it. It was infinite. I knew that. But I can't encapsulate infinite. It had to create form. But there was nothing outside of it, if that makes any sense to you. Finally, I started drawing towards it. And as I drew towards it, I had the sense of actual cords of like a rope or a cord made to an event in my life. And the event would blossom. It was something that I passed through or something that was important to me, and I kind of re-experienced it. And again, this is what I find is a fairly typical NDE experience. And I would visit or see the experience, and then it would dissolve, and this light would get brighter and closer to me. And these events repeated themselves, and the light would get brighter and closer and brighter and closer. And one event was interesting, though. It was something that I really attached myself strongly to, apparently. Something that I really suffered and sacrificed for. Something that identifies Jim, who Jim is. And if I was to let go of it, would be letting go of something that's important that identifies me. And I remember rearing up in the face of this incredible, loving presence. Something that we would all seek and want in our lives. Rearing up and saying, I'm not going to let that one go. And as I said it, I thought, this is ludicrous. This is something I want. And I'm staying attached to something I've suffered for that's keeping me away from it. But I wasn't going to let it go. I just was in the stalemate for a few moments. And then finally it kind of dissolved on its own, but I recognized it remained unresolved. Other events continued to well up. And then finally, after I don't know how many times this happened, I began to feel this light start impinging on me. For the first time, I felt my body. I had the sense of being myself, Jim, still, but I had no identity with my body at that point. And I began to feel myself merge with this light. And my feet and legs started filling with light. The love, beingness, infinite presence began just to fill me. It was a compellingness just to merge with it. I mean, anything that we could call, I mean, if God is infinite, then it was beyond me. It was beyond my capacity to understand, because anything that we can name, anything we can say has a form to it. It's beyond any capacity. So my mind couldn't grasp any of it, but it could dissolve into the wholeness of it. The light began to get into my trunk. It would start filling my arms, but mostly my legs. And as it started filling my arms and got into my trunk, I realized that as I merged with the light, the identity of Jim began to soften. And I became more identified with the light that was timeless, spaceless, identity of this. It was this love. It was indescribable. It was incredible. Everything that I would ever want was fulfilled in that line. And Jim would disappear if Jim merged with it fully. And that scared me, so I withdrew from it. I had volition. I withdrew. The sense of identity solidified again. My body became whole again as I know it. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. So I began to merge with it again. The same thing happened. And I would withdraw, emerge again, and I played on that boundary for what seemed like hours. And I'd emerge as far as I could into the light, feel that sense of identity soften, and almost disappear. The sense of time would disappear. I became more timeless. And then I would draw that sense of thinking of me and the planet, me with family, and I'd bring other relations into it and watch all these dissolve into oneness. It was just, again, indescribable.
That's quite the angle.
It was. It was. And, well, she's screaming at me, calling.
Heard not a thing.
Like, oh, I didn't hear any of that. I was dancing with the universe. Sorry about that, dear.
No, you made it up to me by taking dancing lessons.
Even though I still can't do the tango, I danced with the universe. But one thing that I really puzzled at is I merged most fully that I could bear with this light. The sense of Jim began to soften and become infinite. I went as far as I could dare as I lost my own volition to make choices and to identify as I became identified with the light itself. I realized that if I went a little bit further, I would become the light and I would become dimensionless. I would become infinite. The one thing the light does not have, the light, when I mean the light, the infinite aspect, is creation itself. It's infinite, it's whole. We are that light. That light contains everything. When I turned around and looked metaphorically at the planet, at this human life, this is the paper mache. This is the illusion. Creation requires the illusion. It requires you and me. It requires space. In order for me to form a word or a concept, it requires something in contrast to it. Black requires light in order for it to be known. For us to merge into the unity of who we are, we just become that oneness. And the one mystery that I will have while I'm in this life is what would have happened if I had fully merged with it. Anyway, I played on that boundary for what seemed like hours. The one thing I don't remember of the whole NDE is at some point I just felt myself withdraw from it. I didn't choose to come back. I was just playing, I was dancing away. And maybe she yanked me, or I heard her finally going, getting pretty irritated.
Okay.
But all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, here I go. I'm heading back to the planet. And the whole light started withdrawing. My consciousness became more physical and solid in this 3D normal waking consciousness study. And I was left then with some very interesting after effects. Severe heart damage. I couldn't sit up in bed without chest pains, left arm pain, very classic heart attack effects. Very severe cognitive dysfunction. I was put on long-term disability at that point. So it's been quite a journey since 1997. I'm still in that journey, which is fascinating to me. I was able to get back to work in 2003, worked until last May. I don't see myself on disability. I'm carving out a new career. Over the last 20 years, I've been writing a book called Kai-Assisted Creation, and I've interviewed scores of people who have been terminally ill or in deep crisis that have recreated their lives and often healed in the process, even after the doctor said, hey, you've got 6 months to live. There's a very clear pattern among those people. And at some point, what they do is say, this is the function I do have. This is what I do want right now. I can take my wheelchair. I've got a breath. I've got this capacity. How do I live the fullest today? I'll take a step into it. It took me about 3 years to learn how to do that myself after the MBE. the doctors all said, hey, you've got cognitive function in the 5th percentile. And I did. I mean, I lived it out. So what can you do with that? Not much. And one day I got a call from an organization that asked me to do a talk in L.A. and Chicago on how consciousness is changing in humanity. It's something I had done a lot of research on. I flatly said, no, thank you. I couldn't do it. Couldn't stand in front of the group and do that. And then I reflected on that, and I had, our relationship was stressed at that point. I was sitting around doing nothing, and I said, you know, I'm safe on disability here, but is that the way I want to live my life? And I said, no. I called him up. I said, you know, I'll do it. I got 6 months to put a simple lecture today together. I can find a way to do that. The reason I bring up the story is that within that 6 months, I made a PowerPoint presentation. This was in 2002. And I put a lecture together that was about this thick for an hour lecture. Every 30 seconds, I had a page. So that if I lost my place, or someone interrupted me, and I got confused, I could go to the next page, and it would keep the continuity up for the audience. And then I had this whole PowerPoint thing together to keep me on track. When I went to the conference in LA, what was fascinating is that the morning of my talk, I put my lecture right in the middle of the bed, went down to breakfast because I was the first speaker, came up after breakfast, and the lecture's gone. I found it later that the maid had come up and I made the bed, and she had tucked it in under the TV with the TV gun. I found it finally when I got. And the other thing that had happened is that I'd worked for months on this PowerPoint slide, and I had never bothered to take it out of the computer. I had created these wonderful slides, but my computer didn't have the capacity to put it on disk. They were too big. I went essentially naked, standing in front of this group. And I think it was Spirit saying, Jim, you have the capacity to do this. So Tina has helped me put this one together, and we actually have it up on the screen. And I'm not sure, we just put it together today, so we'll see what happens. The one piece that I see that creates miracles is I work with injured men and women throughout the last 20 years. I could tell when they will succeed when I ask them the question of, what are you wanting in your life? When they say, this is what I'm wanting to create. Or as one person who was ready to be pensioned after years and years and years of rehab work, I asked her, what do you want? She says, you know, I want to get back into life. I knew at that moment that she would succeed, that she'd follow that. If we deal with fixing problems, that's all we do. That's all we deal with, is fix problems. What I'm doing right now is getting back into life. I'm following a career. I can talk. At least I'm opening up to something that is in my heart. I know we as individuals on this planet are merging our physicality with spirit. There's a tremendous change happening here. And it's creating chaos, but out of that chaos will come only creation. In the process, we're challenged with letting go of old beliefs and stepping into new ways of being with ourselves and with our world. And that's where we want to go here in the next half of the presentation on how do we integrate these higher states.
So by the way, the actual diagnosis of his near-death experience was a grand mal seizure with heart complications. He had both a heart attack and a grand mal seizure together, and the bleeding mouth was his tongue. He bit his tongue. When a baby is born, you know, isn't it a miracle? And you're forever changed. But maybe first of all of you who are parents, you don't sleep for the first few years. But there's this other change. There's this real awe, at least from what I know of life. I mean, how does this happen? I remember when I was pregnant with both my sons, I felt like a spaceship. I was the capsule. And there was my little astronaut in there. It's just a miracle. But the same thing can happen to one, a sense of wonder, a sense of awe, when you have a sighting. You know, how many of you have watched that lovely program, Touched by an Angel? I mean, most of us have. It's just beautiful and everything, but honestly, if you had a wonderful person in your life and all of a sudden they start glowing in front of you, I am an angel sent from God. As lovely and as divine and, oh my gosh, this is God speaking through this angel as it is. You know, how many of you wouldn't be just a little bit scared? I've seen all kinds of miraculous things happen, and yet that sense of wonder and that sense of awe is often very mixed in with fear. I think it is really a human condition. What is happening now, though, what I'm seeing on the planet now, you know, just in my observations of every day, not just my clients or my family and friends, but just everyday living, is that more and more people they're sensing something. And maybe they'll get a little afraid of it, calm down, and move forward with it more and more and more often. You know, after the initial first few moments of holding this little baby, you know, in my hands and everything, one starts to get used to the fact that, okay, this is a presence, this is going to be with me for a while. And it's the same thing with any of these kinds of experiences. This is something that's going to be with me for a while. And so in Jim's case, and I'm not going to speak for you, the way you're moving into life now, or through life now, it's this near-death experience is with you. It's a part of him. There ain't no taking away this experience. Most NDEers will tell you, that wasn't a dream. That was a very dramatically important event in my life. It wasn't a dream. You don't even experience it as a dream. You experience it as more real than real. And so these experiences, out-of-body experiences, does anybody have what would be called an out-of-body experience? You feel like you were somewhere else? Were you scared? Anybody want to share? Anybody courageous?
I did have it a few times. It was very scary. Actually, it's strange, but it felt very normal.
It felt very normal to you?
I learned very little about it when it did happen.
Yeah, it kept happening. This is who we are.
I never knew anything. I never had it.
So what he said is it seemed very normal. He had it three times, this experience of out-of-body. It was more of an experience, you said, of who we are. Now, there is another reaction. And again, it points to now you're moving forward with, you're just moving through life, having had that experience, but it's just part of the experience. It's not something that just should stop us. But it often does. These kinds of experiences, we have to allow people to have whatever experiences they have. For the near-death experiencer, for the person who starts seeing auras, for the person who has an out-of-body experience, for the person who has an angel sighting or 2 or 10 or 15, for the person who sees other kinds of beings or dimensions or that kind of thing, the world can be a bit of a lonely place. Do you talk to about this? And that's why there's wonderful organizations like this with the courage to examine this with an open heart and with compassion. Because a person's experience is a person's experience. I will never, ever deny you your experience. No way. First of all, I'm not you. And secondly, for me, God is vast and vastly accepting and loving. That's my knowing or my belief. And so I'm not going to deny you your experience by saying, well, you couldn't have. I mean, and out of the body. No, your body's right there and your soul's attached and is sewn in. What are you talking about? And yet people do. We do. I mean, you know, you have to admit that sometimes you hear something and, it's a little bit, it's a little bit out of my experience. But all I ask of you tonight is, if you get nothing else out of this particular meditation, is that you open your hearts just a little bit. That people are having these experiences millions of times a day. I don't know. You know, there isn't anybody except God monitoring all of this. But this is happening, folks. And it is up to us to show compassion and be there for each other. And especially if a friend of yours, or a loved one, or even if a total stranger came up to you and said, I don't know who to talk to, but I had this experience. Be with them. Be present with them. Because every experience is very, very unique. Do you want to use your slides now?
Sure. I can't read
so, it. Okay, you're not going to be able to read this, so let me just talk about this. Transformative experiences is what we are calling things like near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, seeing auras, feeling things. You know, when you get the chilly willies, or prophecy. Prophecy. A number of you know what that experience is like, or you have read it about it, of course, in the Bible or in other sacred texts. Prophecy is a transformative experience. In the transformative experience, if you're having, say, let's just focus in on a near-death experience for tonight, some of the common characteristics is a sense of being in the moment, timelessness. You know, to Jim, his experience was hours long, if he could figure that out, lasted at most a few minutes, till the time that he came back in his body and started breathing normally after the grand mal seizure, right? So, but in that expanded state, there is no time. There's a sense of ecstasy or bliss, of overwhelming love. It's a transcendent experience often. When I started tuning into the aura of my first husband and then subsequent auras, every once in a while I just thought, wow, we're all walking angels. How is this? You know, but in that state of just, ooh, it's transcendent. It's unconditional. There's a higher state of knowing, not information, not education, but knowing. When you just know something, you get it here, you get it here, you just know. You're expanded. The overview, the big picture, the mountaintop, this is very, very common to near-death experiencers. They get a life review, and often about very small events in their lives. You think, you know, oh, this was the most important period of my life. It was you, were you kind to your neighbor? You have the big picture. You can see just about everything. This is what's at least described to me by other people. Egoless, no ego, no sense necessarily of, well, here I am, Elka, just kind of thrashing around down here on the planet. You're something else, again, kind of a living angel. Non-local, what do I mean by that? Physicists talk about non-local consciousness. Psychologists are beginning to talk about it too. And even some people who are into religious studies and philosophers. Non-local consciousness means that it's not confined to the brain. It has been discovered, and over again, we heard this at the conference we just came to, the Science and Consciousness Conference in Santa Fe, that consciousness, not matter, not what we think is real, is the actual basis of the universe, and it's non-local. It is not confined to the brain. People who have had near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences will tell you that they've seen details there is no way they could have known about. So it's non-local, and that's what I mean by that. Pure love, we talked about that, unconditional love, no conditions. If there's no definition sometimes, you know, I don't know, Jim, I think you struggled for quite some time to actually explain the experience, right?
Well, parts of it can't be.
It's unexplainable often. Part of my work is to explain to people what they look like energetically and how they are walking angels, as I call them. But it takes me a while sometimes to describe what I see. Sometimes in these expanded states, you just don't have words. It's undefinable or ill-defined. And then multidimensional. And what do I mean by that? Well, I can't do the math. It is something beyond what we, you know, what I consider 3D, three-dimensional. You know, we have time and we have space and we grow old and, you know, we have a body. But this is beyond all that. Well, then the event has happened, right? Something's happened. I first started seeing auras. He'd had a near-death experience. Others of you had an out-of-body experience. You met an angel. You saw your grandmother who has been... who passed away several years ago. Then there's the crashing back down to Earth. Isn't it more dramatic? And what do we pay attention to? The bad news or the good stuff? So initial reactions is emotional chaos. And so you've gone from this lovely, pure, you know, love state to emotional chaos. You're from expansion to boxed in. From knowing, remember I talked about knowing, to figuring out, okay, what just happened? Or what was I doing when I first started seeing auras, right? Let's try to figure it out. Endorphins. Instead of the mountaintop, the expansion, you're limited now all of a sudden. Or a lot of people describe it this way. It's as if you're descending into the fog. And I know that you have occasional fog and smog here down in Salt Lake City area. And you know how it is when it's a beautiful, bright, sunny day and you can see everything crisp and clear and those mountains are out there. Wow. And then it gets fogged in. And you can't, I remember the first time I moved to the West Coast and there's a mountain called Mount Rainier. It's 14,000 feet high, which is significant, right? But, and we're at sea level in Seattle. And so, you know, that's a big old mountain. And when you go to the national park and you sit in front of it, I cried my eyes out. But the next time I went, it was fogged in. The mountain was still there, right? God is still there. The angel is still there, or whatever. The expansion is still there. But the fog was preventing me from seeing this mountain. So there is often this feeling of closed in all of a sudden, being slammed back into this body again, especially for near-death experiences. Instead of ego-less, ego-dominant. I am Elka, hear me roar. No, yeah. It's just, you know, I have personality, sometimes good, sometimes bad. You know, it's ego-dominant. I have to admit, you know, I'm a very spiritual person, but I have a healthy ego. So you become more attached to a personality. Localized physical, you know, again, back in the body, instead of non-local, timeless, limitless, stuck in duality. Have you heard of that term, duality? Basically, it's this. I'm talking to you, and you are sitting in that chair, hopefully listening to me. And I'm talking to you over there, and you're falling asleep. So there's a duality. In other words, there is a me and a you and a them and a building and a body and, okay, separation. Whereas in the transcendent space of near-death experience, there isn't any of that. Conceptual, based on belief. That's kind of a hard one to describe, but basically, we need to, as humans, and this is a wonderful role of our religious beliefs, of our faith, we need to put something around these experiences. And so that's very, very natural for us to use our beliefs to describe what just happened. Whereas a lot of people have said to me, I was beyond that. I didn't have any words to describe it. But now all of a sudden we're back here and it's just, you know, okay, we need to find something. Science, my faith, my religion, what my parents told me, something to describe. And that's what we mean by conceptual. And then last, flatland. And I'll have Jim talk a little bit more about that, but the basics of that is that a lot of people feel that this is, as Jim said very nicely, this is the cardboard experience.
How many people here know Bill English? When I was here last, I met Bill, and very taken by him and his story, very gentleman. Just talked to him again today. Over the last, as I said, the last 20 years, I've sought out people that have gone through a great crisis and have transformed themselves through that crisis. It took me a number of interviews before I could hear some of the things they said. And one of the things that they all said was, that was a gift to me. Cancer, a broken neck. And they said, it's a gift to me. And I started asking, well, why? Why? What? I asked Bill about it tonight. I said, as we were talking, I said, you know, I've interviewed people, and some of the people that I've worked with, one woman who had ALS. ALS is Lou Gehrig's disease. It's an always fatal disease. She was a quadriplegic and just a few months to live. And as she let go of having to survive and began to see the presence of life just as she was, she saw the miracle of life just as it was and transformed herself. She saw the miracle in life just as she was. And she forgot to die. That was in 1988. And I talked to her a few months ago. she has since done research on this, and she said, I talked to a woman who was dying of ALS, one of many, who said, you know what? If they could find a cure for ALS and fix this, and I lost what I gained because of ALS, I wouldn't take the cure. And I told Bill that story today, and he said, you know, I agree. What I've gained is so powerful through what I've experienced here that I don't think I could have gotten it any other way. There's a man who runs the Resource Center for the Handicapped in Seattle. He was a high school football player. Put his head down to show his coach how good he was. Broke his neck. He's quadriplegic. Most quadriplegics don't live as long as he does. I interviewed him a number of years ago. And he said the same thing. He says, you know, I don't know that I could have reached the quality of life experience and the state of being that I have without that. That's hard to grasp. I've tried to put this into picture somehow. The quality of experience that, you know, the words that I'm trying to reach for to communicate the level of being that I open to in that NDE. I can't communicate it to you. I can't even grasp it in my mind. I knew when I came back from that experience that I couldn't retain even a fragment of, or I did retain only a fragment of what I experienced. I knew that in 3 weeks, it would just be a memory. That the immensity of what I opened up to, of who we really are as human beings, what we can contain in these bodies and these minds is just a scrap of it. The minds can go down a dimension. So let's try that. Think of a two-dimensional bug. We got a little two-dimensional bug here. It's trapped in a box. It knows what top is, and it knows what a bottom is, and it knows what a side is, and it's trapped there. And it can prove it. You know, the best science of bug in the world, in 2D world, can prove that he's trapped in there. And you can say, as a 3D person, say, hey, just go up, jump over it. There is no over in a 2D world. Well, go under it then. Well, there's no under in a 2D world. He's trapped forever. So then there's a 3D bug that comes along and he says, look, I'll show you what 3D is. Here, let me draw it for you. Look at it. And the 2D bug says, no, you're just making it worse. Look, I'll make it bigger. Look, I'll show you. And the 2D bug says, no, you're making it boxier. Hey, look, help. Now you made me a tiny little box. And the 3D bug says, look, all you have to do is climb out of it, stupid. And the 2D bug says, look, you've just made me into a little jail here. But now, as 3D people, don't most people see a cube there? Okay, we live in a 3D world. Well, right there is a piece of paper that's only 2D, and yet we see three dimensions. In three dimensions, we don't lose it. We can lay it out on even a 2D world. Well, there's an interesting artist that I found, Julian Bieber, if anybody's ever seen his artwork. He's a sidewalk artist. And he uses one perspective. He takes a camera, and from one particular perspective, through the camera, he very carefully creates a painting that looks three-dimensional.
These are chalk drawings.
They're chalk drawings on a sidewalk.
On a sidewalk, flat.
Doesn't that look like a 3D, like a sailboat there? Well, it's a painting on a sidewalk. Thought that was fascinating. We start, in our 3D world, it becomes a little confusing. You know, is that really a 2D world there, or is that three dimensions? So our minds, who think in 3D, even when something's laid on the two-dimensionals, it wants to make it three-dimensional. But if you were to take a bug and let it wander across that screen, no matter what you do about it, it's going to create two dimensions. No matter how much you do in the way of training and teaching, that bug is only going to see in two dimensions. If you take a look at that, there's Julian Bieber tell me what is 2D and what is 3D in that picture. That's a tough one to sort out, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, you'd be really lost if the sideline lines weren't there. Right? Where we run into difficulty is then, how do we project ourselves from three dimensions to four dimensions? We can only guess from here. But let's envision here. Look at the floor underneath us from two dimensions. The three dimensions permeate every square inch of this floor. Four dimensions permeates every square inch of our three dimensions. When we say we're going to get there, we're using our three-dimensional thought, thinking that there is somewhere else to get. If you look at NDE states, you notice that it's something that people open up to as they lose the three dimensions, as this life crumbles in three dimensions. So we'll make an attempt to look at what that is. If we look at an egg, as it cracks open, the people that I work with that are in deep crisis, when they finally let go and their egg's all cracked, when they finally let go, what they see is that light is already within them. And it starts shining forth. With near-death experiences, with people that go through great trauma, when they finally let go of their past, when they finally let go of the, you know, clinging to the remnants of the world that they know and surrender, what they experience is that light that they've been seeking pours forth from inside them. Now, the classic NDE is meeting that light out in front of people. The individual starts approaching this light as an individual entity. What I experienced in my NDE was approaching the light and then actually becoming, well, more fusing with the light. And if I had totally merged with the light, then all identification disappears. All dimensions collapse. What we saw in the conference, whether it was philosophers, medical doctors, physicists, psychologists, is that when they talked about the essence, they were saying the same things. It's in the moment. It's presence. All dimensions collapse in the present moment. Infinite. Our choice to create is in the moment. It was fascinating to hear these experts from around the world using the same terminology, talking about presence. Very simple. And then they would try to encase it in their, you know, the language of their discipline. But they kept coming back to this one focal point of presence. And it's been fascinating to see this trajectory towards this one focal point over the last several years.
Yeah, I just want to point out, if you have a chance and you have access to the internet, I would look up a gentleman, for instance, named Amit, A-M-I-T, Goswami, G-O-S-W-A-M-I. He's a very, very brilliant physicist. He's been featured in a number of feature movies about all kinds of topics. But he actually has proven the existence of God through science. Wonderful gentleman of total bright light, and so compassionate and so unassuming, but he says there has to be an existence of God because what physicists are finding, again, is that consciousness is the basis of the universe.
So within that, infinite, all varieties, you know, all possibilities exist. And I think we have two lines of actually Elka sees.
So this is my feeble two-dimensional representation. I state this with all humility. I am very, very honored to have people from all around this wonderful planet of ours come to my tiny little town, my tiny little office, to have me render what I call aura portraits. When Holy Spirit spoke to me a few years ago, a number of years ago now, 20 years ago, and said, you might want to do something with this gift, okay? I was shown that, hey, why don't I try to draw what I see around people and point out to each of you how magnificent you actually are. Out of that infinite, you know, we are spirit in human form. And I didn't put any boo-boos on this painting. I mean, I actually see illness and that sort of thing as well. But what we have here is a representation of our wonderful friend Eldon. This is Eldon's aura. And I know it looks a little odd, I'm sure, to some of your eyes. Now, naturally, you're going to have to use your imagination because it was a painting. And yet his aura extends out all around him. The colors have meaning to me. Blue is the color of the search for the truth. And this is a man who is searching and searching and searching and just loves, you know, loves teaching and researching about the truth. Green is a healing color, and, you know, and so perhaps he has some healing coming into his life. But all this demonstrates, though, is that there is something else going on that just, and the next slide is, this is another wonderful new friend of mine by the name of Susan, who's Eldon's wife. And again, this is my humble representation. I'm not a classically trained artist by any means. But basically, she's surrounded by a color that represents to me unconditional love. She is a very, very loving and creative woman. That's often the turquoise part, the blue part outside, is very creative. And the beautiful kind of a purple blue that's surrounding her also has a meaning to it. It means that she's very intuitive and very in touch with God or spirit. These are just some of the things that I see in my strange little world. And yet, it's only to demonstrate, in my small way, that we are so much more. It is said in the good book that we are created in his image, right? I really feel that we are not just human, but we are light as well. What we're wanting to leave you with. That near-death experiences, seeing things, feeling things, engaging with the greater world, the greater universe, can bring us to tears. It can bring us to fear. It can bring us to, oh my God, now what? But it also can bring us to this, using our gifts. You all were born with a purpose. You were all born with gifts. I challenge you, use them. Don't be just sitting on your butts and not. God has given you each something. Do something with that something. This is one of the things that I do. I also do healing work and healing ministry. It doesn't really matter. My God loves me and says, great, you want to do that now? Cool. Just as long as you're using your gifts. What the near-death experience is a gift. I feel that my sweetie is doing is that he's using his gift to share with you all, to share that he knows that we are so much more than you can even imagine. I'm so proud of him. Because he's stepping forward into something new, but he's also stepping into something that he was made for, and that these experiences, we're walking together. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone who wants to raise your hand and ask a question of these two, please feel free.
You spoke about your near-death experience, but you said you had two of them. Was the other one similar?
No, it was quite different. I had a surgery in 2005 to replace the prosthetic valve. It was a very extended surgery. The first valve had done so much damage to the heart that they didn't know whether they could. I was very unaware of the drama that she was. Evidently, I visited her during that. She knew it. My only experience of it was a very severe PTSD, post-traumatic stress. Afterwards, for about a day after the event, I spent several days in the hospital, contrary to the first time. And every time I breathed out, I would leave my body and then snap back in a panic. And that persisted for about a day. But I didn't have any distinct memory of it, but she had it.
I will talk about this just very briefly. My experience was when he was being wheeled off to surgery, we had done a lot of prayer work together. We'd done a lot of preparation for the surgery. We found an incredible surgeon who was not only exceedingly skillful, but a faith-filled man. You know, when he took us to his office and he was showing was it a PowerPoint or something of your heart and how it was malfunctioning? I started looking around the room and I thought, oh, well, there's a picture of his children. That's a good sign, you know. But then I saw a beautiful picture of a surgical suite Everybody dressed up, you know, in their gear and all doing their thing. And standing behind one of the main surgeon was Jesus. So I thought, okay, we've got a good guy. The day the surgery came, we had done a lot of prep work, I think spiritually, emotionally, as much as we could do. And as he was being wheeled off, I remember thinking, now what is he saying? Because this is Mr. Consciousness. He loves talking about it anytime he can. So even under anesthesia, he's telling the beautiful anesthesiologist, so what we have found in the consciousness is in our hearts to, I don't know what he was saying, but I was thinking, oh my gosh, these may be the last words that I hear from the man. And off he went. Near this hospital was a beautiful little chapel on a university campus. And I remember at one point running down to the chapel. Every once in a while, they gave you a beeper. And then somebody would beep me, and I'd run to the phone in the waiting room, pick up the phone, and they would kind of tell me what the progress was on this 9-hour surgery. In between beeps, I ran down to this chapel, lit a candle, said some prayers, and was just running back up to the hospital when there was Jim standing in front of me. I mean, just as plain as day. No, surgical gown or anything, just my Jim, as if we were going to meet for lunch. And I said, Jim, honey, what are you doing? He looked weird, though. He was pointing over his shoulder, and he said, well, aren't I supposed to move on? And then he said it again. Aren't I supposed to move on? And I thought, uh-oh. I said, no. Honey, again. Your body is being prepared for you to go back into. So you go ahead and take a little journey. But when it's time, then you can go back into your body, please. And then it faded. Because the next thing I thought is, what's going on? So I went into prayer, and I saw a very interesting image. Again, a surgical suite. And I saw our wonderful doctor in a very weird pose. His eyes were closed, and his hands were down like this, and he was still as stone, as if he was holding a prayer, healing. Just quiet. And that's it. And then my pager went off, and I ran back up and talked to the anesthesiologist gal, and she said, well, now, Mrs. McCartney, if you don't hear from us for a little while, it's just because we're in kind of a crucial section of the surgery. And I'm thinking, yeah, right, what's going on with my husband? But she says, so don't worry, you know, it's going fairly well. And that was that. And then in the jigs and the reels of the aftermath, hours later, he came out. And well, the next day after the surgery, the surgeon comes in and he says, you, young man, were my greatest challenge in 20 years of surgery. I said to him, yeah, I was wondering, what happened at about 11:13, something like that in the morning? And he said, wow, you're good. I don't know what he meant by that, but, you know, he said, well, I'll tell you. We got to his heart valve, and the old one was put in a little crooked because they had to put in a bigger one. They only had, you know, a couple of sizes in those days. And because he was athletic, they put in a bigger one, and they made a tear in his aorta. And by the time 30 years went on, there was all this junk. There was all these, you know, this calcium deposits. So they had to clean it all up, and guess what? There was no aorta to attach a valve to, just a couple of spaghetti threads. And guess what? You know, they had to take a chunk of his heart out. There was nothing to attach a valve to. You get the picture? This was not good. And can you imagine, you know, being that surgeon? So I said, what did you do? Because he's here. And he said, I've never done this in my life, but I closed my eyes and I said a prayer, and my eyes were closed for a good 5 minutes, and all I saw was picture of all the possibilities of what I could do. And what he did next was he landed on one picture, and he turned it around in his mind in 3D. And he said, I can do that. Opened his eyes. Can you imagine the rest of the staff? I mean, his eyes are so close. You know, instructions, please. I mean, you know, here's this guy. He's open. What are we going to do? But anyway, and he did this thing. Jim is a patchwork quilt. Instead, so yeah, they reconstructed the aorta. with some Dacron and some other patches, and they sewed a patch onto his heart, and it's an amazing thing. And so the near-death experience was actually, in a way, mine. See, this is what I mean by non-local as well. How could I have known any of these things? Anyway, I hope that answers your
question. Thank you.
The doc came by when I did come through this morning and asked how I was doing. Said something like feeling like I'd been driven over by a truck or something. He kind of looked at me and said, you know, good day to be alive.
That's right.
And turned around and I read it and I said, you know, whatever I said wasn't the right thing.
Nice positive
influence. Something else.
Yes.
What are some of the books that you've enjoyed and
either of us or
helped you?
Actually, the people that have inspired me the most are people that I've interviewed that have gone through deep crisis. People that finally turned around and said, wow, life is a miracle no matter what. And when I go through my bumps and grinds, I think about, you know, if they can see the miracle in life, even if they're dying, I can do that with my problem. And one man that comes to mind is a physicist that was dying. As I know him, he was in a wheelchair. 17 patents to his name, had his own company, top of the pyramid, top of the stack. But he wasn't happy. He was dying of an incurable disease, became wheelchair bound, and transformed his life through that.
Became a healer.
Hands-on healer as part of it. And when I talked to him, became friends with him, I asked him, well, what was it? You know, ruined your career? You can't have sex. You can't get out of a wheelchair. You can't go to the bathroom. You can't. What was it all to you? And he looked me right in the eyes and he said, that damn thing never happened. And then when he was, we became friends for a number of years. And then when he was dying, I asked him, okay, it's all over in a few months. You know that. I'm going to ask you again, what was all this to you? And he said, you know, I experienced an equanimity in my life I never had before. Now, this is a guy that got his bachelor's degree when he was 18 years old. And he was on top of the food chain. Said, I'm a physicist. I could go into a nuclear power plant and all the engineers bow down to you. I mean, I'm king. And I was never happy. I didn't know what life was. And it took that crisis for me to wake up to a whole dimension that I didn't know existed. And so I use people like that as my heroes. They open up to a breadth and depth of life that is available to all of us. All we need to do is choose it, and we don't need the crisis to do so.
So it's in the stories that we mostly enjoy and get our information. It's in the people who come to us. I would say that any of the near-death experience books available are fabulous, starting with the original Raymond Moody's Life After Life, which is mainly stories of people transcending this realm. There are a few books written about auras. There's a wonderful author out of New York called Barbara Ann Brennan. She was a physicist. Gosh, what do I mean, physicist or somehow? She was a physicist, astrophysicist, actually, and started seeing auras spontaneously. And first book was called Hands of Light. Look for it, though, folks, because Jim McCartney is, as we speak, finishing up, and I'm assisting in editing the final copy of called Crisis to Creation. So look for it. There's going to be very beautiful stories in it, but also it's exactly what we're talking about tonight. Crisis to Creation is by Jim McCartney. I'm writing a book also. I'm writing two at the same time, being crazy as I am. One will be about transformational experiences, auras, NDEs, that kind of thing. And then another one is called The Kitchen Sage. And it's a book about the future. It takes place 40 years in the future. And what I've decided to do was to use an expanded site. And if I were 40 years older than me and talking to me in my now, what would I have to say about the future? So you might want to look for that one, too. Yes,
ma'am. I've got a question for Jim. If you had to, could you identify or give a name to the entity that was in the aura? Who was it?
That I was approaching?
In your experience, describe this.
As I approach the light?
Yes.
There is no entity. An entity requires something other than an entity. Infinity has no boundaries. And so the infinity of consciousness is containing it all. You and I are contained within that infinite. As I merged with this, all separation, all name, all time, all space, collapsed into the infinite.
There were no words spoken.
No words spoken. Beyond words. As I dissolve, all separation dissolved into infinity.
And love.
Love. Just pure beingness love. Mm-hmm. Indescribable. So if you look at the teachings throughout the world, they all point to it, but that's all they can point to it. Any belief is a form. It's caught within separation. If I ask you, who are you, for instance, all you can tell me is names. And each name has to be in contrast to what it's not. All contrasts disappear as I approach this. I never eliminated all contrasts where I wouldn't be here. Well, I don't think I would be.
Were there any principles taught to you?
Principles required that as well. I transcended all of that. One of the principles that I learned on the pathway, as I described these cords, were these beliefs, these attachments that I have about what is true about the world. As I let them dissolve, I allowed myself to experience higher and higher truths.
May I say something, Jim?
Sure.
One of the things that I noticed about James and a number of other near-death experiencers is that principles, the aftermath is that principles such as unconditional love, being in service to humankind, you know, on and on, the golden rule, was not only something that they read, you know, in the Bible and, okay, I'll try my best, but they live it. And so principles come out of these experiences. And from what I've experienced with Jim is that principles naturally came out of this experience with God or Allah or Yahweh or, you know, Jehovah or whatever. But it is nameless, you know, in the experience. Once you come back down to earth, more and more of the people we're meeting who've had near-death experiences and other crises and things, they just naturally expand into these principles that are taught in these good works and these good books.
I've been saying this for 10 years, and most near-death experiencers, when they enter this tomb of the light and the that they meet a being, gives them unconditional love, that understands everything about them, mm-hmm. that he knows their past history. And if you ask them who they think that was, they'll usually say, well, it was God, or it was Jesus Christ, or they refer to deity. So this is a little bit different.
Yeah.
And maybe you're more advanced than the rest of us.
I don't know about that.
I'm not sure that I understand what you said.
Yeah, what I got was source. If you look at teachings, what I'm getting more and more from people that are experiencing these states is they struggle for words and really say, you know, it's a spiritual experience. I could say that it was an entity because it's more than just a name. You know, I can't wrap just a name around it. And they'll say, I had an upbringing of a religion, and it's more than just that form. I honor that, but it can't be contained just within that. Well, let me just tell you a story, because you see all religions tell stories. because the parables say more than just the words. Mafia hitman had a near-death experience. And he was a bad man, you know, kind of a low-level guy that was just out there doing this thing. After this near-death experience, he spontaneously started living out the Ten Commandments. You know, he started spontaneously wanting to go out and help kids. His girlfriend was really pissed because he didn't value the important things in life anymore. He didn't like the jewels. He didn't like the good stuff. She was really angry at him because he wanted to take the gold jewels and stuff and go out and help people. But that's a real natural response when the ego structure, the little self, breaks apart. And what's inside of us, that egg, what's already inside of us, is the infinite. We have to clothe ourselves, because in order for us to communicate, we have to have that illusion of separation. But what's already inside us is the infinite. And my own experience is that as we recognize that, we'll start acting in harmony spontaneously with one another. We start living out those higher commandments that you see embodied in all of us. You know, the kinds of separation and conflict we see in the world will start changing. Pretty radically.
I was curious about your aura. Do you see them only with people you interact with, or do you see them all the time?
24/7. I mean, literally. So there's green menorahs. I see them all the time. This whole room is filled with them. And you have a pretty pink one.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's 24/7. Honestly, it's not an easy life at times. I'll be bluntly frank with you. I'll be bluntly eloquent with you even. Because I see the light and the shadow.
Can you see the aura of the whole group since we meet on with each other? Can you also see that?
Yes, groups are very, very interesting dynamics, aura-wise. So, for instance, you know, and this is when I wish I was doing one of my more normal. I actually talk about this and get paid for it and everything. It's kind of crazy, but you know, there you go. I will do some demonstrations of how an aura of a group will grow with the interest level. So, you know, at one point when you were kind of, okay, who are these characters? You know, the auras were a little bit back. But as the interest grew, you know, your auras do move forward. Your auras are now extending to about here. This is the group aura. I'm not making this up. You don't have to believe me, by the way. I have nothing to prove. The fascinating thing is that as your awareness is targeted in on something, your aura actually moves forward. And yet your individual energies as well.
As this fellow being said earlier, in his out experience, I also have been out. There is no fear, none. And I was out many years ago, and I appreciate what Dave said earlier about having a forum or of open minds.
Yes. Oh,
to grow through the experience, because there's not words for it. Jim has helped because it contradicts so much of our existence here and how we're taught to think we are and see it as we think it is. So my coming here was because there's no one to talk to. Who do you talk to?
You can talk to us. Yeah. But, yeah. Come on down.
There are a few people that I can talk to, and so I appreciate it. Thanks for this group figure and the openness, because that's where real growth occurs.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Can anybody want